Hello and welcome to Radio Free Nintendo. This is episode 330. I'm your host, Jonathan Metz, and with me, as always, Guillaume Veillette.
Hi.
And James Jones.
Hi.
And our special guest this week, Alex Calafi.
Hello, Johnny.
Hey, Alex. We've said your name many times on the show because you've written articles and we talk about them in Now Playing. You've been on Connectivity, but I don't think you've really been on RFN before. So welcome, sir. And the reason Alex is here this week is because John Lindemann is packing for his move. Same reason he will not be at PAX East next week. We'll have Nate Andrews in for that. So, and Alex was willing to play along with us on Ease, book one. That's the part we're going to talk about this week later up in the show. First up, of course, as always, we have new business, and Guillaume has a very new 3DS game to talk about.
I do. Hello. My name is Guillaume, and I have an Etrian Odyssey 4 problem. I am totally addicted to this game, and it's pretty bad.
but that's pretty good, right?
Well, it depends, but I've been going to bed at like 1 every night for the past week or so.
So normal bedtimes then?
Not for me. I'm absolutely addicted to Etrian Odyssey 4. I've never played the first three games. I've always wanted to, but then, you know, like it was, you hear about the difficulty and you hear about how punishing and old school it is. And I don't know, like I didn't really want to risk $40 or, you know, $30 on just trying it. And there was always something else on DS coming out that I wanted to play more. So I never checked it out.
Yeah, no shortage of RPGs on DS, but with 3DS, they're a little more rare. So I think, it seems like a lot of people are giving the series a shot with the fourth one. And yeah, the demo definitely had something to do with it as well.
Yeah, the demo was just excellent. It's the start of the game. You can play for a couple of hours. Well, you can play for as long as you want to. It's just that your characters max out at level 10, which does take some time. But other than that, you can basically explore pretty much every dungeon of the first area of the game. You just can't go too in-depth in one of the dungeons, the one with several layers, basically. But yeah, excellent demo, and it really, I think it scratched the itch that Dragon Quest VI didn't quite scratch for me. I never really played an old-school first-person dungeon crawler, and I don't think that I would have enjoyed it if I had to chart like a map on a graph paper and stuff like that. But Etrian Odyssey just makes it easy enough for me to find it enjoyable. And like, I'm just addicted to the exploration and the feeling of, you know, getting stronger and facing more and more powerful enemies. I think that what I really fell in love with was the preparation aspect of the game. It starts right away when you create your team. I had read a lot of, you know, blog entries by Jeremy Parrish about his different parties, and, you know, like I thought I was prepared, so I was like, okay, I think I know what I'm doing. I'm gonna create a fortress who's going to have like a very good taunt ability, so she's gonna absorb all the damage basically. And next to her, I'm going to have a dancer who's going to evade every attack. And then, like, behind, I'm going to have a medic and a sniper, which I assumed would deal a lot of damage from, you know, the second line of my party. Mm-hmm. And then I rounded that up with a rune master, which is basically, like, the wizard of Etrian Odyssey. So I thought I was, you know, creating a good party, but then things don't always turn out as you expect, and after a while, I realized that my party just wasn't dealing any damage at all. So, and especially like the sniper, it turned out that the sniper's abilities are more to kind of cripple the enemy, to stop it from launching some special attacks. So I switched that out after a couple of hours of gameplay. It was a hard decision, but it had to be made. So instead, I've replaced him with your standard fighter, which I put on the front line, and things have been going much better since then. But yeah, like I thought I was prepared, but again, like you have to make a lot of decisions about your party, and each and every one of them is just agonizing. You have every time that you level up, you have to choose to improve, to put a skill point in one of your abilities. And I can just spend like minutes staring at the screen wondering, okay, should I upgrade this or this? Oh, but this could be really good. And I've made a lot of bad decisions probably. Like I thought that my fortress, if I upgraded the taunt ability enough and if I gave her enough resistance to damage, would basically, you know, absorb everything and would keep the rest of them safe. But then like these enemies have splash damage. And they can, like, she's not protected at all against poison, which, you know, deals a lot of damage and is actually effective in this game, unlike many other games, against yourself just as much as against the enemy. So yeah, like, you know, I've made some bad decisions, but I've been progressing, and it's a lot of fun to see, to try to decide, you know, which skills to upgrade and to see your characters do better and better, and then to go back to previous areas and to face foes that you know, you couldn't even scratch before and just decimate them.
It's funny that you're playing this right after a Dragon Quest game, because my impression from the demo was that at least the combat system is a lot like Dragon Quest. You know, though it's all, because it's done from the first person, and you know, you have the character, it moves pretty fast, you know, it's kind of the text kind of flashes up there and you hear a sound effect and then it moves on to the next person. And I think you can actually auto battle if you want to, or even set certain characters to go automatically while you control other ones, which has been in part of Dragon Quest since at least 4.
The automatic battle system is more useful or has more options than Dragon Quest, actually. Like, basically, if you choose auto battle, they all do a regular attack, even if it makes sense or not. It's not like your medic is going to heal the person who needs it, or the rune master is going to cast a spell if it's actually a good idea. They're just going to hit with whatever weapon they have. So it's not really that good, except when you're facing really, really weak enemies. So yeah, like, it can make the really, really easy fights go faster. But other than that, I find that the game is at its best when things are actually really tough for your party, but you still have a chance of winning. So I've been really trying to prepare for battle and then explore as far as I can and, you know, face foes, like actually like try to get out alive with all my characters intact, but also like I like it when there's when the challenge is there. But there comes a point where you do have to face enemies, like you run out of places to explore and you just have to face enemies that are much tougher than you are. So you do have to grind, and that's when the game gets a little bit more tedious for me. I really like the feeling of, you know, killing a really, really tough enemy and feeling like it's because, oh, well, I used a good strategy or I prepared well.
So Guillaume, so I am of the mind that the RPGs that I can play are the very simple ones that are not necessarily too simple, but very accessible, like Chrono Trigger, Pokemon, Xenoblade. I wouldn't like this game, would I?
Well, I don't know. Like, I think that the game is not complicated. I think that's one of the things that put me off from ever trying the series. Mm-hmm. But there's really nothing here that you can't figure out by just, you know, trying a few things or by reading the tutorials.
Hey, try the demo. I mean, the demo is the game.
Yep.
So if you don't like the demo, then I think you'll have a pretty good idea of it. But I tried the demo because, I mean, Alex, I had felt kind of the same way. I was a little worried that this would be a little overly complex or a little too old school for me.
Right.
And I tried the demo, and I was surprised that it was actually more accessible than I expected. And even though it does have its own complications and systems, you know, that you kind of have to learn about. And, you know, drawing the maps when you're exploring dungeons is definitely weird. I don't know if I like it. Even after playing the demo for a couple hours, I don't really know what I think about it. Like, it's interesting, but it also seems kind of like a lot of busy work. And I kind of, you know, at some point I sort of just wish the game would do that for me as I explored. But, you know, I discovered a lot of really cool things about, like, the character art is interesting. And considering it's a first-person game, there's a lot of character art, and it looks really nice. Mm-hmm. And then there's the weird, fully three-dimensional overworld where you literally have an airship from the very beginning of the game. And you go out in this overworld, and you're moving on a three-dimensional grid around the overworld, and you explore it almost like you do the dungeons, and there are enemies roaming around, but you can avoid them, and you can go and find all kinds of, you know, free stuff that you kind of loot out of the ground. And I was just like, when I saw that, I thought, this is like what I wanted RPGs overworlds to be like back in the PlayStation 1 days. Because, I mean, it doesn't, the graphics aren't that great. It does look a bit like a PS1 game or maybe a PS2 game, but you know, it's almost like someone sort of discovered 3D for the first time 10 years, 15 years later. And they said, oh, cool, we can take our concept for an RPG overworld and put it in 3D. And it really is in 3D, and it just looks really cool. I mean, it gave me this kind of, you know, PS1 or N64 kind of feel of exploring that area and being like really excited to find out, you know, what have they hidden all over this world for me to go and explore and find.
Oh, all right.
I wasn't expecting that at all when I turned on Etrian Odyssey, you know, the demo.
Yeah, and the game is not obscure for the sake of being obscure. Like, everything, you can find all the info you need by reading. Like, you do get clear descriptions of what skill does what. The manual's pretty complete. And yeah, like, there's tutorials for basically everything every time that you're introduced to something new. So yeah, like, it's a very, very accessible RPG, and in many ways it's very simple. Like, there's not much of a story to it. There are some bits of dialogue that are pretty funny. Like, they're having fun with setting the mood and things like that. Like, somewhere in the labyrinth, you'll find fruit, and then you get to choose, like, oh, will you risk taking a bite out of it? And, you know, like, oh, which character should try to eat it? And then you'll read the description, like, Emmett bit in the fruit and screamed, but it was a scream of joy. And, you know, then it recharges your magic points, and you're like, oh, phew, you know. So there's not tons of dialogue. There's no really, your characters don't have personalities. They're just classes that you picked, and people react to your party and tell you, oh, you're awesome adventurers. But yeah, like, the combat is very simple. It's turn-based. And what I really like compared to Dragon Quest is that basically every skill that you have actually has a use. And most of the time when you cast something that will cripple the enemy, it actually works. And most of the time when you try to run from a fight, it also actually works.
So more like Pokemon in that sense, maybe.
I wouldn't know. Maybe.
You wouldn't know.
It is very much like Pokemon in that sense.
Well, yeah, I mean the Pokemon battle system is based on the Dragon Quest battle system, but I would say it's a little more consequential, especially because most characters only have a couple of moves, you know, before they have to forget one so they can learn a new one. And so when you get an ability in Pokemon, it tends to have major consequences if you decide to keep it. You know, they tend to, when you use a move that reduces the enemy's attack power in Pokemon, it's a pretty major difference before and after. So you might actually use those moves. Whereas a lot of times in stuff like Final Fantasy or Dragon Quest, when you have a move like that, a lot of times those are kind of, you know, not very, they're kind of gimmicky. They're not very useful in most fights because they don't really have a big effect.
Mm-hmm. And yeah, like, I suppose that the way that you raise your party basically to get more and more powerful can have the same satisfying effect that you would find in a Pokemon game. And if you want, you can name your electric guy Pikachu, and there's nothing to prevent you from making a Pokemon team, so that's pretty cool. I have been actually street passing like 4 different people playing the game, so I got like some street pass stuff from them. Doesn't seem very useful, but yeah, like, you can see their party and what they name people and where they're at in the game. It's pretty cool. Fun. Yep.
Yeah. So, you know, certainly, I don't know that Etrian Odyssey 4 is for everyone, But, you know, I mentioned it last week. We really can't stress enough. You should try the demo. It's on 3DS. It's free. It's several hours long. And it seems really fun. You know, I was very impressed.
You can save your progress in the demo. It lasts hours. And then your save transfers to the main game if you decide to buy it. Mm-hmm. So,
and if you do decide to buy it, you can also download the full game from the eShop. So, you know, yep. You can kind of make a snap judgment and say, I think I want to keep this. I think I want to keep going, and then just go download the game immediately without having to go anywhere. So moving on in new business, Alex has a game that I am very curious to hear more about.
All right. So I have been playing Castlevania Lords of Shadow, Mirror of Fate. I beat it like last week, but I've been doing some catch up this week. And if I may, I would like to draw some comparisons between this game and the Zelda games on CDI.
Oh God!
What? It's not as bad. It's not of a quality kind of thing, but it is very similar in that it's a classic legendary franchise that some new developers took on. They tried to make it their own, like, regardless of the quality, they really wanted to do it justice. And they did everything they could to put their own spin on it. And what you have is this game that's like a weird approximation of what the original formula is, but it's not quite as good.
Okay.
So the story, I won't really spoil it because since it's Lords of Shadow, there is kind of stuff to spoil. But you have the Simon Belmont, Trevor Belmont, Alucard, Dracula. There's a whole plot with them going on. And that's like, it's kind of like Castlevania, but there's this weird Belmont family thing going on that I won't really get into.
Nah, just keep it in the family.
I think they've retconned it so that the character from the console version, Lords of Shadows, that came out a couple years ago, is now Trevor Belmont's father, and Trevor was the character from Castlevania 3, and then Trevor is the father of Simon Belmont, who was in Castlevania 1, and that's not the lineage from the original series at all. I think they've just kind of taken some of the more well-known characters and mashed them together and like, you know, kind of made them direct descendants of each other.
Correct. So the exploration, which was the heavily touted thing in this new game, it's kind of like old Castlevania, where there's always these hidden areas, there are these places you can backtrack to if you want, but it's not really as exciting because the only stuff you can get is like health bonuses, magic bonuses, and experience points, and the entire castle, because it's segmented into three different places for the three different characters, it's way more linear than the Castlevania games of the past.
So you can't just switch between characters anytime you want to.
From the main menu, you can go to each character's section, but they each have their own, like, 2 to 4 hour section of the castle that is totally unique to them and takes advantage of their special powers. So it's
that's
not
disappointing.
Yeah. Not all is bad about it, though, because the combat, which, if you've played the demo, you know it's kind of like 2D God of War, but it also does a few things like projectiles from the original Castlevania. I actually really like the combat because I don't care about old Castlevania that much, but I also really like God of War. Some people complain that the sort of whip that feels like this chain thing that Kratos has, they say that it takes too long to kill an enemy, but it seems carefully balanced to me. Like, it's not improved from the demo, but it seems fine to me.
I think that's a matter of taste, because, you know, if you go back to, and it was a problem that I had with the first Lords of Shadow that I played on Xbox, I guess, which is that, you know, the Castlevania series, almost all the enemies are killed in one hit. In fact, you know, through the first 4 or 5 Castlevania games that were made, there was actually a special enemy that took two hits. That was the ghost. I don't know if you guys remember the ghost, but it was notable specifically because it took two hits to kill, whereas every other enemy in the game, except bosses, only took one. And even the bosses usually only took about 10 hits. It was just a matter of, you know, can you get close enough to do it without taking damage yourself? So Symphony of the Night changed that up a little bit because it's now everything's based on a hit point and damage statistical system. But even then, you know, unless you ventured way beyond where you should be given, you know, your power level or whatever, in general, I feel like the enemies in all of those Metroidvania games, they went down pretty quickly. And especially because the attacks that those characters had were generally very fast. You know, they were more sword-based attacks than like a big whip that has to animate all over the screen. And so it always felt very snappy to me. And in fact, one of the best parts of those games, especially like Aria of Sorrow and Dawn of Sorrow, is like towards the end, you'll get some kind of soul that actually gives you the power to race through the game really fast. Like it's basically the speed boost from Super Metroid, and you can just use it whenever you want to. And that's like the true joy of those games to me, is because they're already fast and then they just get even faster. And at that point you've mastered the game and you're just blazing through it and you're just getting wherever you want to go as fast as possible. And it lets you focus on exploration. And that was my problem with the E3 demo from last year and the one that's on eShop now with Mirror of Fate, is it just feels like they've really kind of ruined the pace of not just the Metroidvania games, but really the entire Castlevania franchise has always been very snappy. You know, the character may not move that fast, but you push through the game at a pretty rapid pace because it's not constantly making you stop and fight things and then move on. And it seems like Mirror of Fate is, I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, but, you know, you say 2D God of War, and God of War very much is, I'm going to hit this guy about 15 times and then I'm going to kill him.
Right. Well, some of the stuff it picks up from God of War I also really like. Some of the bosses, or actually all the bosses in this game, are really well designed, and they feel a lot like the Lords of Shadow in God of War bosses, where they each have multiple stages, they each have these complex patterns that have to be handled, that take a lot of experimentation. It requires actual blocking and dodging even on the normal difficulty to beat them, and as a nice little twist, one thing I like about them is that when you actually get to the point where you lower the life bar to a certain segment, you actually get these 3DS QuickTime events to go through, and they aren't too pervasive like they are in some other games, but I think it's a fun little twist for a handheld console.
Yeah, I mean, if you already like that stuff, I can see why this would appeal to you. But I guess I don't like that stuff very much.
Right.
That's why I haven't. I mean, perfect. I'm a big Castlevania game. I've played over a dozen Castlevanias. Okay. I mean, I'm maybe not at Greg Leahy levels, but I like me some Castlevania, and I own a shit ton of those games. And I just, you know, playing this demo, which is not exactly the same demo between E3 and now, but it's, you know, the same material, just kind of updated a little bit. I just don't really get the sense that they're making the kinds of Castlevania games that I would want. And it's not that I'm adverse to change. In fact, I think change is something this franchise could have used a lot earlier. You know, I mean, they made 6 games in a row for GBA and DS that were really not that different from each other overall. And it was certainly getting stale, but I feel like the changes they're making are not good changes. You know, or at least they're not changes that appeal to me. But, you know, Nate gave it a very strong review at our website, and now you're liking it. I mean, it seems like it's a very love it or hate it kind of a thing. I guess it depends on, so to me, it's not so much your expectations, because I'm certainly open to them rejiggering the formula and doing something different with it. I just don't really like what they have done with it, you know, but some people do.
Yeah, I just wish that developers would let go of the idea that players find it fun to mash a button to open a chest. Like, can we please drop this?
Oh yeah, that's horrible. I know. Even never, from the first God of War game.
Yeah, it was never a good idea.
Yeah. I agree. And the doors too. I mean, God of War is rife with that stuff. It's not even just treasure chests, it's everything. You have to mash.
So let me ask you this. You don't like the chest, which is fine. I don't like the chest kind of thing either. And I hate the doors, how they make you, like, at every single door have to mash a button. But what about at very limited situations where you have to, like, pull a chain to, like, tear a boss apart or something, and then you just have to mash the button as hard as you can. You don't like that? I think it's fun sometimes.
No, I don't, because that's predicated, and in that case, it's not even the mashing that's the problem. It's the fact that they've created this scripted event that they want you to watch, but also play. Mm-hmm. And
but you're not really playing it. You're just
that, right. No. In most cases, you can't really do both equally well. You can't really have a satisfying cutscene that is also interactive. I think very, very few games get it right. I would say RE4 does probably the best job I've ever seen, and most of the actions that you do during cutscenes in RE4 are just button presses, and the fun part of them is that they just come up really unexpectedly and you have very short time. So you're always on alert, but the actual things you're doing on the controller are not annoying. You know, they're not time consuming. They're not, oh, well, you mashed the button, but you didn't mash it fast enough, so we're going to make you fail and do all this over again.
Or even worse. Even worse, there are situations in Fist of the North Star 2 where there's a button prompt, like press A, and I literally got up and went to the bathroom and came back. It still asked me to press A. It was basically, press the button to watch Ken destroy this guy. Like, talk about missing the point even of QTEs, yeah. You know?
Yeah. Well, sorry, I'm hijacking your impressions here, Alex. I apologize.
Oh, that's fine.
I mean, obviously, you like the game. I mean, did you find that it was long enough? Did it have enough variety? Did the characters feel different?
Well, I think it's unfair to say that I liked the game. I
what? The game. God
no,
damn.
No, I love the. I don't
say
love.
It.
I really
say
like
it.
The. Cut it out, James.
Admit that you hate this game.
I really like the combat, and I really, really like the bosses. But I don't think the exploration is very good. I don't think the platforming does anything special. I think the art design is downright ugly. And yeah.
Agree.
Well, no, that's another thing that I drew comparisons to the Unholy Triforce. Because it tries to do this super impressive graphics for the 3DS or back then for the CDI. But it just comes off looking as fake and ugly.
Mm-hmm.
And then the exploration, like, it's just, it's all too linear.
Yeah, from the video I saw, and I watched part of the Giant Bomb Quick Look as well, because I was interested in seeing some more video of the final game and maybe seeing some of the different areas and the different characters. And I really get the sense that the 3D backgrounds are nice. The 3D effect is definitely strong in the demos I've played. And I like the idea of the backgrounds, and that idea really goes back to at least Symphony of the Night for the franchise. That game had at least partially 3D backgrounds, at least in certain parts of the game, and they look cool. You know, you're on a 2D plane, but as you move by, it's kind of a modern version of parallax scrolling. It gives you some feel that even though it's a 2D game, the environment extends way back into the background, and it's a cool atmospheric effect. But I'm not really sure what they gain by making the characters out of polygons, because they look kind of low res, you know,
and then the
animation has, you know, potentially some issues. And from the sense that I got from watching the Giant Bomb thing, and also from playing it to some extent, is that having all the characters, you know, all the heroes and the enemies all be made out of polygons, it kind of chugs down the engine and it lowers the frame rate, and And then that affects the combat, which is very timing based and combo based, and you would like it to feel really smooth. And I feel like if they had just used basically 2D artwork on top of these 3D backgrounds, they could have done something that would, you know, it would flow better, and it would also just kind of look nicer, and you wouldn't have these problems with lack of detail and the kind of murky colors that you get on the character models.
I just don't think that Mercury's team has any experience with 2D sprites.
Well, to me, it was clear that they were the wrong choice to develop this game.
Oh, yeah. Mm.
But, you know, like, it's not that easy. Like, I think it's not something that you can just pick up, like, knowing how to design effectively a sprite-based game. Because the way that you would have to correct every frame of animation, if there's something you want to change later on, like these might be things that 3D developers aren't really used to, you know?
I think this kind of game, especially a 2D kind of exploration game of this sort, you really need people who are dedicated and who are in love with that format and understand how all that stuff is pieced together. And you know, and I'm not saying there aren't people like that at Mercury Steam, the developer, but when their previous project is this giant, you know, 3D ultra cinematic, very self-serious console game, Lords of Shadow, to me, there is nothing in that game. And I played through that entire game and I like it, but nothing in that game indicates to me that they would have the capacity to make a 2D Castlevania game of the sort that they tried to make with Mirror of Fate. And I think the correct choice would have been to go with a team like, I don't know, WayForward Chair would be amazing. The guys who made Shadow Complex. I mean, that would have been fucking perfect for them to make this game. But these guys just, you know, it kind of did what I was, ever since this game was announced, what I was always afraid of, which is that they're going to try to make it too much like the 3D game in terms of style, in terms of pacing and combat. And that stuff, a lot of it just doesn't work on the handheld format. And, you know, having not played the game myself in the full form, but everything I read and see about the game kind of tells me that was my initial impression was correct, is that they just weren't the right choice to make this.
I think the bigger problem with the art style, though, is one that a lot of 3DS developers have. Like, even in Fire Emblem, they try to do this thing where they try to get these GameCube or Wii-S character models in, but because of the power of the 3DS, every single character model that they put in there just ends up looking jaggy and kind of ugly. And I feel like a lot of developers aren't actually playing to the 3DS's strengths.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think
I agree with that
when they try making character models, no one can really do it right. Like, even Super Mario 3D Land doesn't look that good on an XL.
I think it looks pretty awesome, but more importantly, it's smooth. I mean, it has a smooth frame rate, and the 3D effect is really nice, and the, you know, the camera makes sense for that game. I think the graphics are really simple in 3D Land compared to stuff like the Galaxy games, but you kind of expect that from a handheld game. So I think they by limiting the set of, you know, the kinds of assets that they use, by limiting the colors and the size of the environments, they made it work for the format, you know?
Maybe in this case. Yeah. But definitely in Castlevania and Fire Emblem, I stand by the point where they should not have used full-on 3D character models for those games.
Yeah, I don't really have a problem with it in Fire Emblem, but that's not really a graphics... That's not really a game where the graphics are very important, you know? In fact, I'm well, we'll talk about it in a sec, but I've basically turned the graphics off at this point because I'm just trying to blast through it quickly, and it doesn't really affect the experience all that much. So, but in Castlevania, you know, obviously you can't do that. It's an action game. So the graphics do kind of matter. And, you know, especially when the engine that they've built for the game seems to have problems running the graphics, you know, it can't really keep up. I mean, considering how long this game's been in development and how, you know, they delayed it over 6 months from when it was originally supposed to come out, the kind of performance problems that the final version has, I think, are pretty hard to dismiss.
Have you noticed that the frame rate in Mirror of Fate chugs at the exact same 20 to 25 as the original Lords of Shadow?
No, but I think it's pretty, I don't know, pretty inexcusable in a 2D game, you know? In a game that's on a 2D plane where the developer has so much control over what is on the screen at any time because of the fixed perspective. There's really no excuse for frame rate problems, you know. In a 3D game, I can see because you have the player has some control over the camera and you have more agency and, you know, you could be going in any number of directions at the same time. The enemies might kind of gang up on you. I find it a little easier to excuse in a 3D game because of the open-ended nature of it. But in this kind of game, it seems ridiculous, you know, for it to have frame rate problems. Well, thanks for your thoughts, Alex. I'm glad you got some enjoyment out of it. I'm still kind of on the side of I think this game would piss me off more than anything. Like I've had moments where I considered downloading it and just saying fuck it, you know. I mean, maybe one day on sale, you know, I'll be kind of willing to give it more of a shot, but I think I'm going to wait for the next reboot.
The reboot of the reboot.
It's too bad. This is definitely a kind of game I would like to be playing on the 3DS, and it's missing really from the library. This kind of 2D, you know, exploration action game. with or without the RPG elements, I could take or leave that stuff, but there's really not anything else like this. And unfortunately, you know, when they finally released a game that, you know, that is kind of up my alley, the kind of thing I was looking for, it doesn't seem like they really executed on it the way I would like. So I'm going to go next in new business. And, I talked last week about getting a Vita, and at the time I hadn't really put very much time into any single game. This week I am still kind of spreading my attention among several different things, because I still haven't even tried everything I've downloaded. But the one game that I keep coming back to, and I have put a few hours into now, is Gravity Rush. And it's, you know, one of the top games that I wanted to play on the Vita from, you know, from the very beginning. And I've always heard excellent things about it, and I've always wanted to play a lot more of it, and my interest in it has been totally validated, because Gravity Rush is awesome.
Yeah, I mean, I'll be honest, this is the only Vita game that I'm even remotely interested in.
Yeah. So next week at PAX, James, I'll have to make sure you get some time with it. And I've actually been thinking of you quite a bit as I play it, because I know of your interest in stuff like Zone of the Enders. Mm-hmm. And I feel like Gravity Rush, it's a very different game, but there are aspects of it, especially the three-dimensionality of sort of flying through the environments and right. The speed at which you do so, that does remind me of ZOE. And I love those games too. And it's the thrill the thing is, in Gravity Rush, it's almost like a 3D platformer, but there aren't really platforms necessarily in most parts of the game, but there's this really awesome city, and the environment, the city location that they've created is really multi-layered and complex, and things happen on different planes, you know, different heights of the city. There's a lot of things hidden under other things, and the only way to get them is to sort of jump off an edge, flip gravity, and then go to the underside. And even just to look around, I mean, the crazy thing is, your character Kat, who's a really pretty interesting character, other than the cliched amnesia that she has at the beginning of the game.
Well,
she
has everybody in Fire Emblem.
I know. She has a nice personality. And the dialogue that she has with the other characters is legitimately really funny and very well written. And I appreciate the cutscenes a lot more than I was expecting. But the great thing about playing as her is that she doesn't really fly. You know, I mean, you play the game and it's almost like you're flying all over the city, and you can do so almost unlimitedly. I mean, you have a meter that counts down, but it lasts a long time, and you can upgrade it to last even longer. So you can spend a lot of time in zero G. But you don't really fly. Instead, you kind of pick a direction and then she falls in that direction. So she can fall straight up into the air, or she can fall sideways. And the great thing about the physics of the game and the camera and the whole way that it's presented is that it really feels like you're falling every time. It's like constant vertigo, which is maybe unsettling for some people, but it also has that kind of adrenaline rush of the feeling of falling. You know, it's, and so it never feels like you're Superman. I would actually relate it more to VVVVVV. This is like a 3D version of that. It's a classic, you know, and not even just that game, but I mean, gravity flipping goes back to the old Mega Man games and a whole bunch of other stuff, you know, like Low G Man and a lot of crazy stuff like that. But it feels very much like you have control of gravity, whereas in a 2D game that would only let you go up or down, in this 3D game, you can pick literally any direction at any time and fall in that direction. And it always feels like you're falling, even when you get really good at it and you can pinpoint the direction, then you can kind of tweak it while she's in mid fall. You know, you can kind of push her to get around objects. You can stop anytime and pick a new direction and fall again. And now in a different direction, but they've captured that exhilarating feeling so well, and it just doesn't get old. And that's the great thing about this game. It has missions, it has a story. I've heard that later in the game, some of that stuff kind of breaks down. It gets kind of tedious, or it's not as much fun later on. But frankly, you can play this kind of just as an open world platformer. And it's reminding me a lot of stuff like Crackdown and Spider-Man 2, you know, my favorite Spider-Man game. These really good 3D superhero games that have come out over the past 10 years or so, because you have this great city with power-ups, like little crystals and hidden things all over the place, and finding them and collecting them is really fun, and it just doesn't get old. Like, I could spend hours just kind of falling all over the city in every direction you can think of and just trying to look for, you know, hidden surfaces. And, you know, what if I check underneath this place? What if I kind of check on the side of this thing? And just collecting that stuff is so satisfying. It's so much fun. I almost don't even care if the missions are good or not. And so far, most of the missions are fine. I am making progress through the story, and I'm kind of unlocking new areas of the city. And the story is really weird. I don't know that I understand what's going on very much.
That's pretty much expected.
Yeah, but I kind of don't care. Like, just playing the game is such a thrill. I'm super, super happy with it. And, you know, the graphics are fantastic. The music, the soundtrack is amazing. I wasn't expecting that at all. The soundtrack is fucking great. So I'm really, really happy with Gravity Rush. And it's one of the PlayStation Plus games. So, you know, if you have a Vita and you get PlayStation Plus, you essentially get it for free, which is insane, because this is the one Vita game I totally would have paid full price for. And I didn't even have to do that. So for the price I would have paid to buy this game, instead I got a year of PlayStation Plus, which is just ridiculous.
That's
yeah. No,
you got a year of PlayStation Plus and the game.
I can't wait to show you guys this game, because to me this is a game that's very easy to fall in love with. And in fact, once you're actually playing it and you're getting to roam around the city, you will fall in love with it very fast, I think. To me it clicks on every level. I'm so, so happy about it. And that's all I've got, so let's move on to James.
Yep, so I have been pouring through Ease Book 1, which my exploits were fully well documented.
Mm.
They're
in the Library of Congress at this point.
Well, to be fair, I tweet like once a month, so it's just going to happen all at one time.
Yeah, I think you just tweeted for the next 200 months or so. While you're playing through Ease.
I tweeted something like 116 times over the course of 3 days. It's a lot,
that's a lot, man.
it's fine, but if you spread that over 30 days, you wouldn't think that's all that much.
It was entertaining.
Primarily, that little diatribe helped me, and I'll talk about it later, but what I played on the side, and I've been doing this on and off for the last month at this point, was just sort of consuming regularly the downloadable stuff that's come out for Fire Emblem Awakening, of which there has been a tremendous amount.
Dude, there were 3 new DLC levels paid, released just today.
Yeah, and I haven't even gotten to those yet. I mean,
some of them are Smash Brothers themed, which is very circular.
What?
Oh, are you serious? I haven't looked at the ones that came out.
It's called
today.
Like Smash Reunion or something like that. I think
Smash Brethren.
Oh.
Smash Brethren. That is fantastic.
The people who made this game are fully self-aware that DLC is really just their. So there's 2 types of downloadable stuff in this game. There's the paid DLC, which are these individual battles or these packs of battles, and you'll usually end up buying the pack because you get a free battle out of it, and then waiting for a month for them to release the last game in the pack. But I went through that with the second pack. The other ones are the on-disc DLC on-cart DLC that they unlock periodically through Spot Pass.
Oh, is that just the bonus box stuff?
Yeah, the bonus box stuff.
Yeah, all that's free. Yeah.
Yeah. So there's 2 varieties of the bonus box stuff. There's the battlefield map with the enemies that feature a bunch of previous Fire Emblem characters. I think if you win, you get one of them. And those are fun battles, but there's not much to them. They're really just like fighting the random enemies on map. But the other ones are these story-related event battles that give you the opportunity to earn the loyalty of a character from the game's story.
Oh, really?
Which is kind of interesting, because it's usually not a character you would expect. So one of the ones you can earn is the final boss of Act 1, without spoiling it. And another one is the final boss of Act 2. I mean, these are really important characters in the game's plot that also turn out to be really goddamn powerful.
So when you say win the loyalty, you mean they join your team?
Yeah, and you can use them in battle. They interact well. They usually only interact with the tactician. For whatever reason, they don't have supports with the other characters. But, you know, in battle, they'll say things. They're not just like these relatively generic characters that the classic characters you get from going into the the Outrealm Gate are. They're, you know, they're real integrated into the story characters. The third one, which just came out today, is interesting because it is a character that you are told died. I won't go into detail who that is because it's a relative's. Their death is somewhat of a spoiler, but it is an important character that dies in the game that suddenly comes back with amnesia, of course.
Is it Superman?
Yes, it's Superman. Because everyone in this game has amnesia. There are, at this point in my party, 5 characters with amnesia.
Oh, good grief.
Well, it is contagious. I mean,
The tactician has amnesia, and the tactician's child also has amnesia. Because why not? It's genetic. Well,
it's hereditary.
It is hit a point. Now, one of the characters that has amnesia, explicitly I don't say as such, but they are a character from another Fire Emblem game that had amnesia in that game, so I'm going to count them. It is like Amnesiacs Anonymous in my party at this point.
I was about to say that.
It is
I'm
a
glad
miracle
you made that
they
joke.
Even know what they are fighting for at this point, because they have no clue who the hell they are. It is bizarre. But I'm so pleased with the free stuff is cool. But these paid levels are, you know, they're set aside from the story. They take place outside of the world the story takes place in. And in fact, the characters, your party is continually annoyed at the fact they keep getting taken to this place outside of their world. And they make comments about how completely insane everything is in this outworld. Because usually it's completely asinine scenarios, like zombies have stolen all the world's gold. or there's just like these ghosts of former heroes who are guarding these treasures, the Infinite Regalia, which is a cool level. But the ghosts just keep introducing themselves and insisting you come back to fight them because apparently they're bored as crap. And every time your characters try to leave, they're like, one more thing! And everybody goes, oh god, no, please. I want to leave. Apparently there's a mission that takes place in a hot spring that comes later. It's just really ridiculous, goofy stuff that they said, all right, this is for fun. Let's actually make it fun and goofy and ridiculous. And I'm actually okay with that because I really didn't like the first few DLC because they were super easy. But the last one, the Infinite Regalia one that I played, is difficult. I'm told the ones in the packs that came out today are difficult. And the pack that I haven't bought yet, the third pack, is supposed to be relatively difficult. But these ones you get for free, the ones that you get from Spot Pass, are really properly challenging. And they actually make me feel like I have some desire to play my party that, at this point, could rock the end boss. You know, just like, whatever, dude. Poke him and he falls over dead.
Yeah, I mean, you already beat the game, right? So
yeah. It's nice, though, that they're adding content that can help you in the beginning of the game and in the middle of the game. But there's also adding stuff that at the end of the game gives you a reason to reopen the 3DS.
Yeah.
And presumably give Nintendo your money.
Yeah.
Now, so one thing that came out today somewhat unrelated to that, but related to the game itself, is that this game has sold, was it 100, it was 160? 80,
I think it was 180,000.
180,000 copies in North America since it came out.
In the first month.
Which is the physical stuff.
Well, the physical stuff is 116,000, I believe, which means they sold 60-some thousand digital copies of this game. At $40 a piece, that's $2.5 million. That's $2.5 million of pure profit.
Which probably equals the profit they've made on all the retail copies, even though it's for a lot fewer units.
Well, and how much do you think it cost them to make this game?
I really don't have any sense, you know, for 3DS stuff.
I know a lot of old Wii games were about 10. So you figure this game just killed it in Japan.
Yeah.
It's killing it in the US. It's going to release in Europe. It's going to do well there.
Yeah.
When this game was first announced, I had no concept that Nintendo was going to release a Fire Emblem game and it was going to be a moneymaker for them. I don't think Nintendo had a concept that was going to happen. But you think about the DLC that it did really well for them in Japan. They haven't said how well it's doing for them here. And in fact, the fact they said anything at all about the retail sales of this game is kind of amazing. But they basically said it because it didn't crack the top 20. People were like, whoa, I thought it was doing better than that. Dude, it totally deserves it. It's great.
What about you, though? Do you feel that, like, you're buying the DLC. Do you feel that you're getting a good value for your dollar?
So I haven't bought any since the second pack came out. I bought the first I bought the first package. That was $450 because I got the free one that they had in the first few weeks.
Yeah.
And then I bought the second one. The second one, I didn't feel like I really got much out of it because it was a bunch of, you know, stat, you know, it was like, hey, this is for grinding. You can level up really fast here. Or, hey, this one gives you a ton of money. I already had a ton of money. I didn't really need to grind, so none of this was a real big net gain for me. Infinite Regalia, though, the last one, was such a cool mission. I've played it multiple times. It was really challenging. That I think, as a whole, I got about $6 worth of content. I wouldn't say any of them individually was worth the $3 asking price. But as a unit of the three, I think they're worth $6.
So with the bundle discount?
Yeah, I would. I'm looking into what came out this week. I'm probably due to buy either the pack that they would have finished up this week releasing or the next one that came out. Because I don't know how much DLC there actually is. I know it's all out in Japan, I believe.
Yeah, they're done with it there. But the game came out almost a year ago in Japan. So
but
it's
there is a ton of it. I know that much. Yeah. And I don't know that I'm going to buy all of it, but they've pretty well extracted money from me so far for this game. So yeah. They've gotten over $50 and had basically every cent of it was profit for them. So,
but at the same time, they've also given, you know, they're also giving away a pretty impressive amount of free stuff.
Yeah, a ton of
which,
it. I mean,
which is very clever because it makes your 3DS light up and it gets you to open the game. It gets you, you know, it gets it in your Street Pass record so that you let other people know that you've been playing it. It keeps people talking about it week to week. I mean, this is really smart stuff and it's kind of unexplored territory for Nintendo first party. You know, they haven't really dealt with DLC very much in the past. I think with Layton.
No, I mean, this was their first DLC game.
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, the Professor Layton stuff had DLC, but
kinda.
Wasn't Nintendo developed. It wasn't even Nintendo published in Japan.
And it wasn't really download content. You more or less was just an unlock.
It was all kind of a, you know, it was kind of a ploy. Everybody knew it was kind of fake.
Yeah.
And the thing about Layton's material is that, you know, the individual puzzles usually aren't unique and, you know, they're usually not all that special enough that you're going to go out and like tell your friends, oh man, did you play the new Layton puzzle that came out this week? You know, whereas the Fire Emblem stuff, it has story elements, you know, it has all uniquely named characters and it's more substantive content that you could actually create conversations about.
Yeah.
But you rearrange matches to form 33.
I can. Can you rearrange the dog to what it looks like after it got hit by the car?
Oh.
Which is still the most macabre Layton puzzle ever.
That's a real thing?
Yes. It's a dog viewed from the side with two sets of legs, and then you just move one set of legs on each set to the top of the body. And now it's viewed from above. It's pretty grotesque. I remember getting it and just laughing for a good 5 minutes. I'm like, are you serious? What the hell?
So I'm not really in the market for paid DLC on Fire Emblem. I'm still trying to play the main quest.
No, I get that.
I wanted to give a little bit of an update on it. I've obviously been going through the game a lot more slowly than James did, as usual. But I felt like I'd been playing it quite a bit and really wasn't making any progress. And so I'd been stuck on like chapter 5, maybe chapter 6 for a while. And, you know, I'd gotten Donald in the paralogue, which is like a side mission, but he's not going to help me get through the next chapter because he's, you know, really weak at first.
Yeah.
And you know, people talk about grinding, but like most of the random battles and the unlock stuff from DLC was over my head. I mean, I couldn't really do it. I don't have enough places on the map to generate a lot of random battles that I can just go grind on. So the whole aspect of, you know, people say, well, this is the easiest Fire Emblem because you can go grind. I don't know that that's the case early in the game. Later on, that makes more sense because you have more options. But early on, I felt like I was playing pretty conservatively, and yet the results of the mission time and time again were that I was not playing conservatively enough. And I thought, you know, if I play this any more slowly and meticulously, it's not going to be fun at all. So I looked at my activities log on the 3DS. So my game file, you know, within the game told me that I had played for 5 hours. The 3DS activity log, which is the truth sayer of the system, told me I'd actually played the game for over 9 hours.
Yes.
So that is over 4 hours of gameplay in Fire Emblem that I had thrown away because the battle was going so poorly and I was losing, you know, important characters. And frankly, you know, late in the game, I might be willing to let some people die because I've spent a lot of time with them. They've done their duty. But when I'm losing characters that are level two,
yeah, that's bad.
That might end up being my favorite character. I'm so early in the game, I don't even know who's worth keeping.
Have you been playing normal
and
or hard?
It's so normal. It's so fucking hard. I mean,
yeah, it could be. I mean,
I'm pretty sure I'm decent at strategy games. I just beat XCOM. I've been playing strategy games for 20 years. I don't understand how people are so good at Fire Emblem and I'm so bad at it. But I said, you know, I am at serious risk of never playing this game again. I paid $40 to download this game. I would like to get through most of it. So I made the difficult decision that James recommended several weeks ago, which is just start over on casual and get back to where you are.
It's just so much more fun that way. I mean,
it is. It really is.
I mean, the only reason you have to restart chapters now are you're just totally getting fucked, and there's no chance you have.
And
a
that's
victory.
Not going to happen because that's the thing. There's a thin line in Fire Emblem between I'm doing really well and I'm doing really well, but I lost a character.
Yeah.
There's a very thin line there. And in that space is the part where I was not having fun because I could be totally dominating this mission. And at the very end, some random crap happens, some enemy that I didn't even see because he's on a flying mount and he comes from halfway across the level and finds the one character who's exposed just enough that they're vulnerable and that character gets killed. And it's like, dude, I didn't make a single mistake up to this point. I'm dominating these enemies and then I get fucked. Right at the very end. It is infuriating. That's not fun. That is not the level of stress that I would like to be having from this game.
Well, and the game has stuff that is even more obscene later, like mages who can shoot electricity from halfway across the map. You can't even fucking see them, and they're just sniping the crap out of you. And you're just sitting there going, ugh. What the fuck did I do?
Yeah, well, now that I'm on casual, I'm no longer afraid of that. In fact, I'm now able to play this game so gung-ho that I've turned off the enemy's turn being displayed.
Oh,
so
wow.
I make my – not only do I not see the battle animations, and that's just a pure time-saving thing, but because I'm not really in any danger of, you know, needing to restart the mission, because again, I think I'm actually not that bad at this game, and I think my characters are not severely underleveled or anything like that. It's just I was getting, you know, I was getting bitten by really stupid random crap. So at this point, I tell my dudes where to go, I have them attack the enemies, and then when my turn's over, the screen kind of fades to black and it comes back and it's my turn again. And some of the enemies have moved around and some of my dudes have lost health, but I don't care, you know?
I can just move on. The only thing you can run into now is when you're trying to recruit characters. I mean, they get nuked before you even get a chance to get to them or something. But a lot of times you can add the character in the battle because you'll talk to them and they'll turn blue. And then they can die, but you still get them.
Yeah. Yeah.
So the only real problem are the ones that you just can't get to in time unless you do it
and
just right.
And I haven't even encountered that yet. So yeah. To put it shortly, I am enjoying the game a lot more this way. I am almost completely caught up to where I was in the span of about 90 minutes.
I told you it'd be really quick.
For what had taken me 9 hours to accomplish on, you know, classic mode.
Yeah.
So I know the purists hate this, but I really, really have to recommend to people that they use casual mode. And by the way, the ability to save during battles is just a no-brainer. I mean, that is infuriating not being able to do that on the classic mode.
I didn't even realize that's what it meant until late in the game that I'm like, oh, are you serious?
Well, it's when I saw that there were two save slots, and I was like, why would there be two slots for a quick save? And I realized going to casual mode not only means that your characters don't permanently die, it also means you can make a hard save during the missions, which is just common sense. That's just modern game design. So, and that's something, by the way, that I'm used to, but you know, like even from playing XCOM last year and early this year, is that even that game is very hard. And when characters die, they fucking die. Okay. Just like in Fire Emblem, but it's not as punishing because it's a PC game. You can save and load anytime you want to. And just adding that, they could put the permadeath back in for Fire Emblem. I wouldn't even care as long as you let me create a save point so I can go off and make a really dumb mistake and then roll back two turns and do it differently.
Or just so you can, feel fine. Like you can experiment. I mean, so
yeah.
It's a nice to be able to do something and say, what are the limits? A lot of times in the game, you're using your characters, you know, it's sort of the allegory of the submarine captain, you know, how deep can the submarine go? I don't know. Let's find out. It's like, once you cross a threshold with the character, they're going to get killed. So it's like, well, how much can this person really do? I don't really know. You have to try to sort of try them out, and this gives you the ability to sort of feel out, okay, the thief doesn't really do a ton of damage, although in this case he does do a lot of damage, but nobody ever freaking hits him. It says they're going to hit him, but his luck's so high they always miss. So, yeah, I'm willing to throw him out there and just say, all right, let's see what happens.
Yeah.
And just basically leave him out there as just a distraction.
It's just more fun to play the game this way.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. It is.
It just is.
I'm having more fun this way. The stress is – I mean, there's still some stress because my decisions still make a difference. I could still lose the mission.
Right. You could still fuck up. I mean, it's
Which is a good thing. You know, right. It makes me thoughtful. I'm not just throwing units all over the place and saying, whatever, go out there and, you know,
let's
good
get
luck.
Some.
Woo! I'm still playing a strategy game with strategy, but I don't hate it anymore.
Right.
So yeah, I'm very happy with my decision, and I apologize to James for it taking me this long to listen to you.
It's fine. I, you know, when I played it, did you up the difficulty any when you went to casual?
No, I just stayed on normal.
Yes, that's how I sort of compensated.
It seemed to be a good balance, you know, other than the permadeath thing.
Yeah, that's sort of how I compensate a little bit. I upped the difficulty slightly to give myself, you know, the real prospect of being, you know, being beaten. But
you also understand the nuances of Fire Emblem AI a lot better than I do. Because
such
this
as
game,
it is.
As we've talked about and we did on Retroactive with Sacred
Such
Stone,
as it is.
You understand the behavior of the units, which is different from one game to another. But within the Fire Emblem franchise, it seems to be fairly consistent. And I just don't play enough Fire Emblem games to, you know, to be able to predict what's going to happen. So anyway, that's all. I just wanted to tack that on at the end. All right, so we're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we'll be doing Retroactive number 26, part 1, with Ease, book 1.
Here's a quick look at the best original content at our website, now playing at NintendoWorldReport.com.
First up this week, we've got a blog, Nintendo Collector's Journal, a weekly edition by Justin Berube. Sleeping on the Pokemon, dreaming of the Pokemon, living like a master, a Pokemon master. This week, Justin bought used Pokemon sheets and, more importantly, Fire Emblem 3DS. Remember, this is a video feature, so be sure to check it out on the NWR Exclusives YouTube channel as well as on the website. We gotta get them clicks.
We have a review, Kersploosh, on the 3DS eShop by Curtis Bonds. Throwing things down a well can be satisfying. Rocks, coins, bodies, anyway, are fun to chuck down into the seemingly bottomless abyss. Hearing it plink along the way, Kersploosh, is a game about that. It's also about avoiding obstacles in the well and reaching the watery depths. As satisfying as that is, the game is less than an hour, and as a result, it isn't much of a splash. Gersploosh!
It's the worst name.
Next up, we got a review for Nano Assault EX for the 3DS eShop by Rory Cocker. As opposed to simply publishing the 3DS launch title, Nano Assault on the eShop EX is an enhanced version of its predecessor. And of course, it's really good. Probably not good enough to buy again, but if you waited then, go get on it.
I did wait.
There you go. Go get on it. Go. Now. Stop recording. Yeah. We also have a preview of Need for Speed Most Wanted for Wii U by Tyler Olu. Oh my god, the Criterion game on Wii U. Oh, that's stuff.
It's been about a decade.
Oh.
Since Burnout 2.
We also have a review of Lego City Undercover on the Wii U by Neil. The oddly anticipated Grand Theft Lego is finally here, and it turns out the odd anticipation was oddly worth it. Odd. Lots of collectibles and missions are only somewhat diminished by a lack of depth.
All right. A lot of stuff going on. It's the first retail Wii U release in 3 months. So if you've been derelict on your duties, now is the time to start heading back over to NintendoWorldReport.com for our coverage of LEGO City Undercover, Monster Hunter, and everything else happening on the 3DS and the Wii U right now.
Do it now.
Kersploosh! Awesome.
Welcome back, everyone. It's time for Retroactive. This is the 26th... That's hard to say. This is the 26th time we've done it. And the game, of course, as you know, is Ys Book 1 and 2, which is really two games put together. They were, I think, originally released on PC in Japan. And then for the TurboGrafx-CD, or the Turbo CD, Falcom released a version that included both Book 1 and Book 2 together on a CD that had redone music and special animation scenes, etc. Some voice acting, which was very special at the time.
It's very
90s.
Special now.
Yeah. And they packaged them together. And most people now know of these two, you know, Book 1 and Book 2 as basically being two parts of the same game. I think they were released separately in the first place a long time ago, but they're typically now seen as parts of the same game. And it makes sense because Book 1 is really pretty short. It's only, you know, maybe 5 or 6 total hours. And then Book 2 is somewhat longer than that, but they flow into each other so directly that it just kind of makes sense to play them back to back. That's kind of, you know, that's kind of the best way to do it. So for this first part of Retroactive, we're going to pick it back up in a couple weeks after PAX. But for this first part, I thought we would focus on Book 1 because it's kind of, you know, it's the first part of the game. It's fairly short. It's kind of a nice chunk that we can bite off of and really kind of deal with in one segment. And we'll talk more about Book 2 next time. So I kind of wanted to start out by getting a feel from you guys on, you know, did we all complete Book 1?
Yep.
Yes, we have.
I have read the book. All of
well,
them.
Good. That's rare that we all get to the same.
It's rare we've all played the game sometimes.
Yeah. And I also wanted to talk amongst the group here about, you know, how much of the Ys franchise had we played before this, and what version did we play? I've played a couple of Ys games. I played Ys 3 and the Oathenfell Ghana, which is a remake of Ys 3 and an adaptation. And I've also played Ys Book 1 and 2 back when it first came out on Virtual Console, so about 4 or 5 years ago, and I talked about it some on this show a long time ago. So this was a chance for me to go back and sort of re-experience it from a different perspective now. So I wanted to ask you guys, you know, what's your experience and what version did you end up playing?
I've already talked about my Ys experience on this show.
You played Ys 7 on PSP.
That was the first one, and I played it in two chunks, separated by a couple of years. but it turned out to be much better than I gave it credit for the first time around. And then I tried the Oathenfell Ghana on the PSP, and I kind of lost interest halfway through, to be honest. And this is my first time playing Ys Book 1 and 2. On the Turbo CD version.
And do you find that Book 1 and 2 is a lot different than the,
oh,
you know,
yeah,
the later ones?
Oh, yeah. Played? Like, 7 has a combat system. that basically, it's all about combat. It's very, well, like, Ys Book 1 and 2 is very fast-paced, but not in a good way, in my opinion. But 7 has a lot of complexity to it and different types of weapons and different types of damage that, you know, hurt different enemies in different ways. It's much, much more complex.
Okay. And what about you, Alex?
I have almost no experience. I did get the Oathenfell Ghana from Steam for like $3 after you recommended it on RFN a long time ago. And I kind of ended up where most of my Steam games go that I buy for cheap. Where I get to that 10-minute point where I can finally save, and then I never play it again.
That's too bad. You should go back to it at some point.
I'm interested now.
Okay. Well, good. And what version of Ease Book 1 and 2 did you play?
I played the 2013 Steam version, and there are quite a few differences, which we can get into at some point.
Yeah, that's great. So I think that one's called, what, Ease Chronicles Plus?
Yeah, okay. And they're two separate games, basically. Like, they each have their own credits.
Right.
Oh, okay. Yeah. All right. I'm kind of interested, and I actually, since I had already played some of the Virtual Console release, I actually considered getting the Steam version, but I thought, well, what's the point me spending, you know, $15 on a game that I've already bought once?
Well, yeah, especially since the purpose of the whole thing is to play a Nintendo system.
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't say
yeah,
that.
Yeah, I mean, games on it, the game as it is available on a Nintendo system.
Yeah. That's true. No, I mean, the other part of it was I never finished Ease Book 2 the last time that I tried, and I don't know that I will this time either. I'm still playing it. But I kind of felt like I wanted to reacquaint myself with the Turbo CD version. And then, actually, I'm very interested to hear from you, Alex, about the differences and hear some kind of firsthand experiences. And yeah. Then maybe I'll consider, especially, you know, all the sales that happen on Steam, I could probably end up getting it for a lot less money than it is currently. And so maybe down the road, I will consider that. I actually would really love to play E7 after Guillaume talked about it, but that one is not on Steam, unfortunately.
I think that E7 was made for the PSP. It might not even be on the PC in Japan, so...
Well, guess what? I can play PSP games too now.
Ooh.
As long as they're downloadable. So I need to look into that because I am really interested in that. I mean, especially after you learn to love it.
Yeah, and 8 is coming to Vita, and it's going to be localized by Xseed. And
isn't it the fourth one, but like remade?
I think you're right.
Well, that's fine because I've never played Ease 4 whatsoever, so that's fine too. So James, what about you? Is this your first time with Ease?
So as a connoisseur of video games. This is not my first time with this particular game. It is, however, my first time with this game that I remember, which is sort of an interesting. Because I played a little bit of it in a very weird setting, you know, in somebody's private collection a decade ago.
The amnesia continues to spread.
It's not really amnesia. I played it for a few minutes in a swarm of TG16 games I played over the course of a few hours.
I see.
I mean, I was aware of the series to an extent because, you know, I'm reasonably well informed about that kind of game from that era.
There was a good Retronauts episode about Falcom, and they talked quite a bit. I mean, this is the most famous franchise that Falcom has made, so they spent some time talking about Ease.
It's, yeah, I've got a little tiny bit of experience, but more knowledge about the series than anything.
Okay, and did you play the...
I played the Virtual Console version, yes.
Okay, so there is a version of there was a remake of this for DS.
Yes,
but not really considered to be very good. Mm-hmm. Not terrible, but very flawed, and in some ways they kind of made the game worse versus the original.
It's
console version.
It goes back to that kick of games late 2000s that were ports of 16-bit RPGs that radically changed elements of the original game.
Like Lufia 2.
Yeah,
except this was a much earlier remake, like much earlier in the DS's life.
How early was it?
Yeah,
like 2005.
I think it's probably more like 2006 or 2007. Mm. But yeah, just not the best version of Ease out there.
No.
So anyway, so you get three on playing the Turbo CD version on Virtual Console, and one with the brand new Steam remake, which is awesome. So I wanted to start, we have a number of forum posts here that I'm going to read out, but I wanted to kind of get the first impressions from you guys just in terms of how did you feel playing this game? I mean, it is an unusual game. It really doesn't play quite like anything else. I still do think that Zelda is probably, you know, 2D Zelda, classic Zelda, is probably the closest point of comparison, but Ease feels even very different from that. It just has a very different style and a different pace to it. So how did you guys kind of take to it, and did you grow accustomed to it over time, or are you still kind of struggling with it even now?
Well, it's very much different from the picture I had in my mind. Like, I went into this game not really having watched any videos ever of this game. And yet I had heard about it for a long time, and I was excited to play it. I had bought it, like, a couple of months before it came up for this retroactive. Yeah, like, in my mind, when I heard that, okay, you don't swing your sword, you bump into enemies to damage them, I kind of pictured Zelda when you hold down the sword button. Yeah. And, you know, like, when you just, like, bump into an enemy and, like, it bounces on the shield, and you have to attack a little bit, you know, like, offset from the shield so that you can actually hurt the guard or whatever in A Link to the Past. So that's what it looked like in my mind. And then I played this, and I'm like, what the hell? What is this? I'm a little bit disappointed. And yeah, like the guy is really just running into enemies at a very high speed. And sometimes it hurts him, and sometimes it hurts the enemies. And the game is so fast paced that I have a lot of trouble just, you know, getting used to trying to hit the enemy from, you know, an angle from the side a little bit, you know.
Are you playing at the fast gameplay speed, or are you just, I think by default, it's set to
slow, which is not exactly slow.
Yeah.
Cause I cranked it up to fast. I wanted it to be as fast as possible. Oh yeah. Yeah. I mean, I like the speed of it. I like the ridiculous pace of the game. So I'm happy to play it as fast as possible.
If an enemy happens to touch you, you're dead in, you know, less than a second. Like, they drain your life so fast.
But I got skills, bro.
Whatever.
I do. And I save a lot.
Yeah, a lot of too. Yeah, a lot of the tricks to not getting murdered is really more feathering your attack than it is just going in and blasting them. I observed when I first started playing the game that it looked like I was trampling people to death.
I get that sense too.
It's like, I really hope these are all bandits, because otherwise I'm going to have a hard time sleeping.
Well, and the funny thing is that when you do ram into these enemies to attack them, you push them back.
Yes.
Yeah.
So you do get this sense that you're really kind of pushing the enemies around and having your way with them, as long as you do it correctly. But if the enemy is much more powerful than you, you know, your equipment or your levels are not high enough, or if you just approach it head on rather than at the offset that everyone recommends, then sometimes the enemy will push you back. Mm-hmm. And if you ever stop moving forward, you know, if you hit the enemy and then just stand there, they will destroy you. And if you let them push you around, you're totally fucked. And what the way the dungeons work later on, especially, is that they tend to put you in these hallways and maybe sometimes make you kind of go around corners. And I think those are designed very deliberately because your ability to take out an enemy, especially if the enemy has a lot of hit points and takes a lot of hits, it requires a long path for you to push them. And if you push them and they turn a corner, or you get them back up against a wall, then you can no longer damage them, and you now have to approach them from a different side. And so it's, I'm not saying it's strategic necessarily, but you do have to kind of learn the skill of managing
it's
the space around you so that you have enough room to kill the enemy.
It's not strategic, it's tactical.
But it's very easy. Like, there's another way to approach the enemies, and it's just to, like, bump into them, let them, you know, step back and turn, and then go back at them. Like, you can just basically, if the enemy is above you on the map, then just press up, down, up, down, up, down.
Yeah, that's what I mean when I was saying feather the attack.
Yeah.
Do you guys really play it that way?
Well, I did at the beginning, mostly.
If the situation calls for it.
Yeah, like in those narrow hallways that you mentioned, it's definitely a valid way to approach them. It's probably the only way to approach them.
I disagree, because I never play like that.
So
and I beat the game.
To me, it's really situational. If I'm in rough shape, or I'm in a situation where I know he's backed against the wall, that's one way for me to handle it. Because if you're getting beat up pretty bad, as long as you've got a decent shield, and you just sort of feather the attack on off, on off, on off, on off, there's really, really unlikely they're going to hit you. Because occasionally you do pass through the enemy and take damage. But if you do that, it's pretty unlikely that's going to happen.
Mm-hmm. And Alex, what about you? What are your kind of thoughts on especially the combat mechanic, which is definitely the defining feature of this game?
Well, to tell you the truth, and I guess you guys noticed this too, but the game is really fucking bizarre.
Just slightly.
Well, like, before we even get into the combat, which is very Diablo-esque in my opinion, I thought that the way you traverse the world is very interesting, because all the RPGs I play don't go any farther back than Chrono Trigger, so I wasn't used to there not being an introductory section, and I wasn't used to just being thrown out into the world immediately.
Yeah.
You just got off the boat. Please save our land.
Yeah, or actually, go buy these weapons and save our land.
Yeah.
And it gives the story this very weird, like, Forrest Gump sense to it. Well, let me explain.
Yeah,
I guess.
Yeah.
Do you want me to explain it now, I guess?
Go ahead. I mean, you can't leave a statement like that out there.
Okay, well, it's kind of like Die Hard, too.
No, you stick to the Forrest Gump example.
Okay, it's the same example. But the entire story, it's not an RPG that takes 10 or 20 hours. So what we're left with is this guy who is normal and through the course of a few hours falls into these amazing situations that barely go in sequence to each other. And it's kind of bizarre to watch, where he's just this guy who happens to wake up and then a few hours later he's fighting the King of Darkness.
Well, to me the most amazing part is everybody's like, you have to go save our lands, and nobody explains to him from what or why or what the danger is. He's just like, oh shit, I better go do that. It's like, you just got off a boat, bro.
Doesn't need any explanation either.
Maybe say no.
Well, what else is he going to do? I mean, he doesn't have a job. He doesn't have a home.
This isn't
There's
exactly
nowhere to sleep.
But the best part is, so he go. It ends with him going to this tower that you can't leave. Explicitly, it is a tower no one can leave. And yet everybody in the game is fucking in it. Including this boss they're worried is going to escape, despite the fact it's a tower you can't leave.
The story is... Really, there's barely a story here, although there certainly are plenty of characters with names and their own voices. But the final boss of book one is this guy named Dark Fact,
which is the worst name ever.
I think it's the best name ever, but it's like, for the same reason. But I love that you don't even hear anything about him or even learn his name. You know nothing about this guy until maybe 20 minutes before you fight him.
Pretty much. And all you learn about him is what his name is.
There's no build up to him whatsoever. You know, everybody's like, things are bad. You should really collect these books along with all that. Can you bring me the harmonica and, you know, all this other crazy stuff that they task you with. But it's true. Like, even in the original Legend of Zelda, which predates this game by at least 5 years.
This was 1987 and it originally came out.
Oh, shit. Okay, so the PC versions are much older than I thought then. So that's not... Actually, that's like pretty much the same year as Zelda, right?
I think so.
Yeah.
So I take that back. But even... I mean, it tells you where they're coming from, because Miyamoto does fancy himself a storyteller. And in a simplistic sense, he is a storyteller to some extent. I mean, he at least cares that there's a basic framework for a story, for a narrative, that he wants your character to have some ultimate goal.
Right.
And Ease Book One does not give a shit about that. It's all about, you know, here's the immediate thing that you're supposed to do, because this girl told you to go and collect this seed. Right.
Yeah.
And like that is the extent of the story. And once you collect the seed, maybe they give you the next thing that you need. Oh, now you need to go get this book for me. It's lost in the mine. But you never have a broader sense of why you're doing any
why
of this.
Why is the mine full of fucking enemies? It's the mine.
They're goons, James. They're not enemies.
Yes, but the goons.
It's crazy, because even if you look back at the original Legend of Zelda, they make it very clear up front, at least in the manual, you know, and to the extent that the characters talk to you in very broken English, that the goal is to defeat Ganon and save the princess and to collect the Triforce. I mean, there's three major objectives there, and you're working towards them throughout the entire game. And it's very upfront about that. And in fact, even with the Triforce, they actually show your progress as you go through the game. You're getting this step closer to your ultimate goal. And in Ease Book 1, you don't even know what your ultimate goal is until you're basically on top of him and stabbing him, you know? It's really crazy. I think Book 2 is an improvement in that area, along with a number of other areas, but we'll talk about that in a couple of weeks.
I mean, for me, the funniest part about the plot of book one, besides the fact that you show up and this guy immediately agrees to go spend an ass ton of money to go save a world from something they can't bother to explain to him is a problem. But the fact that all these people are just, there's like a collective of people who are pushing this one random dude to go do all this stuff for them. And yet at the same time, they have the audacity to hold out the items that have been left for you until you go find a stupid harmonica. It's like, if your world is really in that much peril, can't the harmonica wait? No, it can't. It can't wait. The harmonica is vital to the saving of the... No, it's not! You know what's going to happen? In 3 hours, you're going to be in that tower kidnapped. Why? I don't know. Why are you in there? Go play the harmonica then.
Well, she let herself be kidnapped.
But for what? She doesn't do anything!
So she could give you the glasses.
She could have given you before you went in the tower, because she knows you can't read the book.
Yeah,
and she knows you can't get out once you go in.
It's insane!
She sacrificed herself so that you might finish your quest, James.
That you also can't leave.
Even though you don't know what your quest is.
That she can't be bothered to tell you.
No, what's really fucked up about this is that it gives you all these things to do. Everything you say is true, or you have to get a harmonica, bring it back to the girl, which is insanely important. And then your reward is being shown a picture of a tree, and then... after this, the entire story is only explained, 85% of it, through 6 blocks of text that you casually find.
Yes.
That's the entire story.
Actually, block 3 is the best block, because it's like one sentence. It has nothing to do with anything. So there is a random book in the game where it goes, says something like, and they all died, and that's the whole book. You're like,
so the funny thing to me is that the localization of this is actually... remarkably good for the time that it came
out. It's remarkably good for localizing something remarkably bad.
That's the problem. The story is so dumb in the beginning that they can't polish the turd and make it shine. I mean, there's nothing to work with here, and yet the people who translated the text and the voices, I mean, I think the voice acting is cheesy.
Oh, it's bad.
But I've heard much worse.
Definitely. But
and for considering, the Turbo CD version came out, 1990 or 91? It's astonishingly good.
It sounds like it was recorded
then.
In a bathroom, though.
Oh, yeah.
There's such bad echo. It's kind of amazing.
Yeah, it's
the TG CD version is 1989.
No shit.
America, even.
So, for those of us that played it on the TG-16, what was your first reaction when they started talking? Because mine was, what the fuck? And then...
Surprise? And the fact that there's lip-syncing on these really big characters.
Oh, the giant
profiles?
Animus, yes.
It just made me nostalgic for the time when putting a game on a CD was a big thing. And I was like, oh yeah, I remember when Star Wars Rebel Assault it was a game I thought was good. But beyond that,
why do we have to bring up Rebel Assault?
But beyond that,
that game
really
is literally FMV. I mean, it's really bad, like green screen Wing Commander shit.
Yeah, but the animations that you see in this version are really, really basic. Like, I was shocked at how unanimated they were, and I'm kind of surprised. Like, was this? I guess in '89 it would have been a graphical showcase. But...
Yeah, visually it's a very primitive 16-bit game, except for when they put the big giant animated GIFs on screen.
Right, some of them are really impressive. You know, all things considered, and I think a lot of things about Ys, including the story and some of the progression of, collecting these items and, some of the weird stuff that goes on and the design of the mines, a lot of it seems really antiquated now, and it seems goofy because the world has moved on so far beyond that, and the franchise has moved on very far beyond this stuff. But I think if I had played Ys at the time instead of, literally 15 years later,
right.
more than 15 20. Years later, almost. No, I played this back in 2007
or
so. Almost 20 years after it originally came out. But if I'd been 7 years old in '89 when this came out and I played it back then, this would have been my favorite game ever.
Well,
I think it would have blown my fucking mind if I played this back in 1989.
Yeah, because in '89 we hadn't played the Super Mario 3 yet.
Dude, I mean, Final Fantasy came out in 1990 in America.
Yeah.
1990. This game is light years beyond Final Fantasy in terms of presentation and, you know, I mean, the combat mechanics, they are strange as hell, but I still think the combat is really fun. I really, really enjoy the combat in this game.
Yeah, I don't think we would have seen them as weird then as we do now, because they're so against the norms of what essentially evolved this video game combat. I think it's like when you go back and look at characters from the creatures from the Pleistocene, you're like, what the fuck was nature doing with that? Well, at the time, it hadn't really honed in on what works, so it was mostly just like, I don't know. Let's give this a bird with four wings that flies. Let's figure out what happens here.
Well, you know, I think the presentation is an oddity for certain, but to me, the reason Ease is still fun to play is that the mechanics, to me, do hold up, you know, and the puzzle design is infuriating at times, and that, you know, the lack of any kind of auto map feature is really annoying, and not many people are going to make it through this game without checking game facts, because it just, the design is so obtuse. You know, the order that you do things doesn't really make sense.
No. I mean,
there's a point at the end where you have to backtrack 10 floors.
That's when I gave up and said, fine, I'm going to the guide.
Yeah. It doesn't make any sense. I mean, it's not only tedious, it's just illogical.
Yeah.
Like, you would never guess to do that.
I had been using the guide for the dungeons from the moment that, you know, you have to enter that dark cave where you don't see anything.
You made the right call.
Yeah, okay. I think so. So I was looking at those maps, and I was, you know, that's how I finished the game. But when I got to the point where you have to backtrack to, you know, like the floor 11.
You're
when
floor
you're on 21, floor
20. You go to floor 11. Actually, you have to go down to 10 and go back up to 11.
So at that point, I was like, fuck this. I'm going to do even better. I'm going to try the password screen. And so I just looked up the password for, you know, facing the last boss with all the items. And the password is like, I'd say 40 characters long. It's ridiculous.
I didn't even know there were passwords.
Yeah, there
in
are.
This
well, because I think the game was originally password safe.
But by the way, Guillaume, you skipped all of like 5 minutes of the game.
No, he skipped about 30 minutes of having to walk down and walk back up.
No, well, again, I played on the fastest setting, but the whole backtrack thing, I'm not excusing it, but it takes like 5 minutes. I mean, it's not that big of a deal.
As soon as I saw that I had to do that, I was like, no, screw it. But, you know, the joke's on me, because it probably took me 30 minutes to input the password. So
I mean, I have a tweet from when it started and a tweet from when it ended, and it took me about 30 to get all the way down and all the way back up. Because it's
But you're feathering the enemies.
No, well, at that point, I had already hit this spot around floor 19 where you can just rack up levels. Like, there's literally a pathway that enemies have to walk through, and you just run down one side, run back up the other, down, up, and you just gain a level every 7 or 8 times you do it.
So there is grinding in this game.
There is a ton of grinding in this game.
I mean, I think you probably have to do grinding, but for me, I'm curious to hear your guys' opinion, but for me, the grinding never bothered me because you can do it so quickly. It just, you level up pretty fast, and the combat itself is insanely fast. You know, there's no pause whatsoever. You literally don't, you could play almost the entire game without ever stopping your movement. You know, just move forward the entire game and just plow through enemies. And so,
literally,
you know, if they'd ever made me grind for more than like 3 or 4 minutes to make a significant difference, I would have gotten bored. But as it is, the game is just so fast paced that it's like, you know, I'm either listening to the crazy music in the game, or I've got a podcast on or something, and I can gain a level up before I even know what happened. You know, so it never really bothered me. I never felt like I was, in other words, although what I was doing was technically grinding, I'm literally like, man, this boss is too hard. I'm going to have to go kill 100 enemies to get a couple of level ups so I can come back and beat this boss. I mean, that is grinding. But I felt like the word itself, grinding, is a little too harsh for what I was doing. Because what I was really doing was running around the map, blasting fools, in like the most satisfying, enjoyable, you know, painless way you could imagine. And then magically I can now progress. And it took all of like 3 minutes. So it never bothered me at all.
Yeah, I don't know. Like, I think that when you level up, what you see immediately when you level up is your life bar goes up a bit. but you actually gain, you become stronger, like you hit harder, and also you gain more defense. Yeah. So I think it gave me a false sense of leveling up doesn't make much of a difference. And I hit this, I was stuck at this boss, this vampire bat boss, that I just could not finish. Like
that
I,
guy is a fucker.
Yeah.
He's so annoying. So what I did was that I grinded two levels, and, but I was at a point like high enough that each enemy that I killed only yielded one XP. So it took forever. And when I got back, I could stand in the middle of the boss and get no damage.
Yeah. Yeah. So I quit for a night on that guy. And then I was so frustrated because, I mean, I spent probably 30 minutes trying to kill him. Because he just deals so much damage. And it's, oh no, not him. That was the next boss. The Mantis boss is the one I did that on. Yeah. And because, I mean, there's some bad hitboxing going on in that boss. He does an absolute ton of damage to you. That yeah. I had to grind, you know, before I even went back to the boss, I'm like, I can't deal with this guy again. I'll just quit the game. So I went out and got three levels and came back and I housed him. I mean, it was just done, over, battle's done.
The Mantis boss, I actually figured out, like, I could just basically run in a circle and draw the cycles that he throws at you away and then, like, go back from the side. And,
oh, yeah.
And go
I mean,
through
I.
Him, basically.
That fight is mostly about patience.
Well, so the thing is, I was at such a level that, yeah, I could do that for a long time, but hit me four times, I died. I had to hit him like 100 to kill him. I was doing almost no damage to him. And, I mean,
then that's the game telling you need to grind a little bit. Or maybe you missed a piece of equipment, because that can make a huge difference.
So, yeah, in the end, I just had to gain a couple levels and I took him out. But it was ridiculous that, like, it's like there's a mechanical barrier in place going, oh, he's a level 11. Don't let him get through this guy. And I almost beat him, too. Like, I got to a point where I was maybe five hits from killing him. And I got nailed by one of his scythes that clearly didn't hit me. Like, I could see daylight. And I was like, game, we're going to go. This is it. This is the crossing over point. Oh, my God.
Well, I'm curious to know if you guys actually had difficulty levels in the TurboGrafx version.
I don't think so.
I don't. No. Yeah, I think there's only one.
Because the PC version that I played has an easy, normal, and hard difficulty.
That's the plus.
And I played the easy difficulty so I could have it done for today, and I am getting none of the problems that you guys had. Like, I had some really bad backtracking in the Darn Tower.
Yes.
Yeah.
Darm.
Oh yeah.
Tower. When I forgot the evil ring on floor 3, and I had to backtrack from like 16.
No. Wow.
But
yeah.
The trade-off for that was that the bosses were really piss-easy, and I didn't have to do that much grinding.
Yeah, so yeah, that's what happens in this game, though. I was level 36, and I got to the end game, and like the last boss, I was like, fuck you, gone. Done. What now?
So, not surprisingly, the bosses were a very popular topic in the forum thread. And I want to read a couple, because there was a lot of different opinions on you know whether how the bosses are handled in this game,
but only one of them is right.
that's what James would say. I'm surprised to hear you say that, you know? So just to extract a couple of quotes here, No Name 2200 said, especially with the bosses, you can die very quickly in this game. The boss battles in Ease 1 generally suck. To this day, I'm not sure why I sometimes win and sometimes lose. The good news is that they're rare, 5 or 6 total, I think, and that they become much improved in Ease 2. Whereas, in contrast, let's see, Furbansky posted, I'm surprised that a lot of you guys didn't like the boss battles. I felt like they were the best parts of the game, because unlike other enemies, the bosses actually have different move sets, and you actually have to approach them in unique ways. Sure, you still have to just run into them, but it's when and how you run into them that matters. Every other enemy in the game was just the same thing with a different coat of paint. Steamroll, rinse, repeat.
Yeah, I don't know. Like, Again, I think that the way you level up and the way that you gain so much power from one single level kind of imbalances the whole thing. And the only experience I had where the battle seemed kind of satisfying, where I was I felt like the way I played was the reason why I beat the boss was the Mantis one. But the rest, like the very first, the kind of millipede one or whatever it is, like the very first boss, I ran into him and he died and I didn't even know what happened. I was like, what? What? It's over?
You must have been at a very high level. I mean,
guess.
That's kind of the interesting thing about the bosses that, and I guess that's one thing I like about the game, is that the difficulty of it scales so quickly. And it scales both ways, it scales up and down. So a lot of times for me, when I first encountered a boss, I would be underleveled, or maybe in some cases I had actually like missed a set of armor or a sword and I needed to go back and find it. And so a lot of the times when I first encountered the boss, I would get my ass kicked, you know, and it would feel like I'm never doing any damage, or, you know, maybe I find the one moment in his pattern where he is vulnerable. But when I go through there, he just doesn't take enough damage. And meanwhile, he's killing me in two hits, you know, and so I'm never going to do this. So it forced me to go back and look for things I might have missed, or just spend, a few minutes leveling up. And then I would come back and all of a sudden it was almost on the totally other end of the spectrum, where a lot of times the bosses, the second time I came back to them, would be really easy. Or every now and then I would kind of get it in the middle and it would be just right and be very satisfying. But the thing about a game like this is they don't know what level you're going to be when you get there. And so they're kind of, the bosses don't scale at all. They're set at a certain difficulty level and they have certain statistics, you know, based on the strength versus your defense. And so, you know, if you get to them at just the right moment in your character development, there'll be just the right amount of difficulty. But if you get there before or after, you'll have a totally different experience. And I think the way that people play this game, you know, your individual approach based on how aggressive are you or how thorough are you in finding everything, etc., it will have a very strong effect on your experience. And the bosses are kind of the culmination of that, because most of the enemies are so simple that it's almost purely a stat matchup. You know, it's either you're strong enough to kill this dude or you're not. Whereas the bosses are a little more complex than that. And they create these points of, you know, like these nexus points where people have very different experiences based on how they approach it.
I think the experience of A, how much frustration you're willing to put up with, and B, how quickly you are to just back off and say, all right, there's something wrong here. Why can't I beat this guy? I think that is a really strong influence in people's ability to accept the bosses for what they are. I think there are certain bosses, for example, the vampire, where it's not immediately clear how you injure them. That can mm-hmm. be much more frustrating.
Yeah, that guy is not so much even about the levels, but it's pure timing.
Yeah.
There's just a very, very small window that you can hurt him. And once you figure that out, and once you kind of do a little bit of practice and you get used to the timing of how to approach him, he's not very hard. I mean, he'll go down pretty fast, but it's going to take some trial and error for you to figure that out, you know. And he seems impossible at first because the window is so small that you have to attack
him. And the visual cues aren't great either, to be honest.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, the game is so much older than I thought it was that I feel bad criticizing it now. But, you know, like if the your experience with the game is so dependent on being at the right level at the right time, then, you know, here's an idea. Why not ditch the concept of leveling up entirely and deal more with, kind of in the same way that Metroid or Zelda does, you know, through exploration and the upgrade.
Just the pure skill.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I think they were going for a kind of a hybrid.
Yeah, but like this is, I mean, like there is a, I think it is possible to have a very well-paced experience and a very controlled experience, even with a game that has experience points, if the game is linear. But this is mostly like the levels are mazes. So, you know, depending on how much the player gets lost in those mazes, he's going to have a completely different experience against the bosses.
Well, I want to talk about the levels a little bit. We've talked a lot about the bosses, but talk about the levels a bit. Beyond just their backtracking, sometimes they're mazes and sometimes they're not. I mean, sometimes they're just really bad. I mean, I think it's floor 18 of the Darm Tower is one of the worst levels I've ever seen. I mean, I'm talking like Pokemon Mystery Dungeon level of bad. There's a door that just leads to nothing. It just goes a straight line forever. And then there's another door that is in a wall that is basically the size of the doorway. It's, you can just walk around the wall if you want. It's totally bizarre and makes no sense. It feels, and I said this to some, it feels procedurally generated, but it's not. This is something people designed.
Yeah, I think they were going for, you know, trying to create some interesting architecture. You know, it's the idea of putting elements into the level design that aren't directly tied to your progression. Yeah. You know, just having routes that don't necessarily lead anywhere, but which an enemy might corner you in. You know,
right.
So it's almost like a trap, and it may or may not affect you when you go into it, but there's a possibility that some crazy emergent shit's going to happen because the enemy happens to follow you in there. But we actually had a good comment about the level design, especially in the tower, which makes up about a third of the game, probably. The final tower
is long.
I mean, it's, you know, which means it's like 2 hours long. It's not that big because the game is so short, but it is a huge portion of the game.
Well,
so
if you're not playing with the guide, it's longer than that.
Well, maybe so. Ibogaine effect, or maybe Ibogaine effect posted.
Ibogaine.
Okay.
I don't know.
you know, said, you know, it's kind of striking how small the adventure is. I don't know to what extent book one is just a prelude to book two, but the entire game here consists of two small towns, a tiny field that doesn't even qualify as an overworld, two medium dungeons, and one big ass dungeon. And that one big ass dungeon is literally half the total playtime. I don't think this is necessarily a bad thing, but the pacing and structure of the game is just really, really weird. There's never a sense that you're really building or advancing to anything. You just do some odd jobs, then go at the tower, and that's it. We'd kind of talked about some of that stuff before. He goes on to say, Darm Tower is really interesting from an art perspective. It's cool the way they try to represent the 3D structure of the tower in 2D backgrounds. It doesn't really work, and I'm certain the layout doesn't make any physical sense at all, to James's point.
Yeah.
But they do some neat tricks with the parts outside the tower to convey the 3D structure. Mm. I agree. I thought that was kind of cool, you know, and especially like back in 89, man, you would have never, I mean, there's nothing in Zelda, for instance, that even comes close to, even like Link to the Past, which would have been a few years later. There's nothing that kind of captures the sense of place that you get from Darm Tower, because you go from inside to outside, from inside to outside. Actually, the only thing I could compare it to is the end of Crystalis.
Oh.
And I know, James, you're a big fan of that, right? Do you remember the tower at the end of Crystalis?
Oh my god, I didn't even think about that.
I think that game was 90 or 91, so I think it would have been after this, but I actually, playing through Ys Book 1 reminded me of Crystalis in a lot of ways.
You know what?
I
had some moments, but I mean, I was thinking in the almost half minute hero vibe a lot of times.
Hmm.
But
yeah, because of the fast pace.
The pace and the fact that basically the main character is just being told by people who he unquestionably follows to go do shit for them that many times makes no sense.
And don't you just run into the enemies to damage them as well in that game?
Yeah, because the battles are mostly automatic. But yeah, the way that they're shown on the screen is that way. And the thing, Half Minute Hero is a very recent game, and it is a parody. And you have to imagine they had Ys in mind when they were making that. Some of these have to be references to this very game.
It all makes so much sense now.
But yeah, but Crystalis, like, there were a couple moments it popped into my head, but I could never quite, I mean, some of it was, as I referred to them earlier, the anime heads, because they have a lot of the same art style, but there was definitely something there, and the tower is what popped up a lot, so maybe it was pretty subconscious, but you're
right. Well, I thought, like, coming out of the town, like, you really, and seeing the enemies just, like, wandering off the screen is very Crystalis, like, for some reason.
And to me, also, the speed of playing it. You know, Crystalis is a little more methodical, because you can charge up your sword and shoot projectiles,
right.
But Crystalis is a very fast game. I mean, your character just moves, and the enemies move really fast, and they will kill you really fast. And I always love that. I love the kind of immediacy of it. You know, it's just everything is just manic.
It feels much
game.
Faster than Zelda, despite the fact that it obviously takes some inspiration there.
Yeah. And Ys Book, and I think Crystalis maybe was also inspired by this game. You know, especially in the pace of it. Yeah.
The inventory, the way you equip your stuff is very similar.
Oh my god.
It is almost exactly the same.
Oh, it is. I should. So yeah, I didn't equip my stuff.
We're
until...
blowing James's mind right now.
Yeah. So when I went to, so I got all the way to the point of having all my equipment and going to continue the game, and she's like, "You need to go buy this equipment." I'm like, "Fuck you! I already. Oh god, it's not equipped, is it?" And then sure enough, nope. You have to switch over. Oh, game.
Yeah, it confused me as well. Like it looks like. You have equipped what you have bought because it's just right next to, like, there's a picture of a sword next to sword.
Yes.
So, yeah, of course you've got it equipped, but no, you have to press right.
Oh, yes. It's a bad menu. It's really bad. Now, when there's more items there, it makes sense, but when you just got the ones, it's just like, oh, it's supposed to be fine now. It's good to...
So, Crystalis, unfortunately, I'm afraid a lot of our listeners probably aren't familiar with it. There was a remake of it on Game Boy Color that's not that good, unfortunately.
Well, I mean, that's how I played the game most recently, and it's not great. It isn't. But
It's not a good version. If that's the only way you can play it,
It's still a good game because Crystalis is a really good game.
Yeah, but the NES original is fucking classic, really overlooked, amazing gem from that era. And it's probably my number one game that I wish was on Virtual Console.
It's like, until you start talking about the only way to play it, I just assumed it was, because it should be.
It fucking should be, but it's not.
I mean, it's an SNK game. How hard is it for SNK?
Actually, I just did a quick Google search. There are actually multiple petitions to get it on Virtual Console.
It doesn't make any sense. It's SNK.
Yeah. It's Crystalis is amazing. And I think, especially for those who maybe, tried Ease through Retroactive and liked it, or at least liked parts of it, maybe like the mechanics or kind of like the speed of it. This is the next step. Trust me. Go seek out Crystalis. It's fantastic. It's talking about a game that could use a remake, put something on Steam or even on 3DS and just do like a really nice version that's faithful, but captures all the mechanics.
Just go finish buying out the license then and just hand it to somebody to develop. I mean, so they did once for the GBA game.
I used to have dreams about a Crystalis 2.
Oh,
I wanted it so badly.
It's so good.
So
it's an amazing
what does it
game.
Says that we're just like lost, like talking about a much better game?
I don't think it's that. I think it's that this game, it's like what goes back to what I said earlier. It really is Genesis. I mean, it's games as a medium were still very raw at this point, so we can see how certain elements of this game evolved and became more sophisticated titles downstream. And as we collectively talk and identify these things, we see other ones that we didn't see before. I think many of the elements that are in Ease Book 1 that ultimately become parts of future games are many times obscured by the sheer layer of insanity that this game has, to continue the illusion, went extinct. And you can miss these little details that, like, oh, this is the first time that we had fully functioning internal lungs. It's like, because he's got five arms. Well, the
reason that I make reference to all these games that I think were probably inspired by Ease, or at least were similar to it, because I like those games, or in some cases, I love those games. And to me, it's part of the reason that I really appreciate playing through Ease Book 1, even though it's very flawed and it's really weird, But in some ways, it's just not like anything else I've ever played. And yet, the more I think about it, the more I realize, in a lot of ways, it is like other things I've played that I do like better. But I think the fact that I have these points of reference and that it was influential in some really weird, off-kilter ways, it actually endears Ease to me. It makes me appreciate it. It makes me go back and be more excited to jump back into it. And I love the kind of raw, primitive satisfaction there is of running around and killing enemies in this game. There's not anything quite like it. It really is special in that sense. And I know, it's not going to appeal to everyone because it's barely combat. I mean, it's really just moving the character around.
You can argue it isn't.
You can play this game almost without pushing buttons.
And except for the
D-pad. I feel like when I'm going to start playing Book 2, I may have that experience more, just because I still can't believe that this is a 1989 game. Like, the game is so much older than I thought. The way I was thinking about it while playing it and before recording this was, oh, this, you know, like, I'm not sure why people remember this game so fondly. Like, it sounds like the people who really, really, the Genesis owner who really, really loved Beyond Oasis and said, oh, it's a Zelda killer. No, it's not. It's really, really not.
It's not
even a good game. But
and in that case, Beyond Oasis is a Zelda clone. So it's a derivative work. It's
It was kind of a clone of like A Link to the Past in a way, except more. Anyway, like that's
more terrible
that game. But yeah, like this Ys book 1 and 2. Yeah, like Link to the Past didn't even exist. It was probably not even like thought up yet.
This game does things. Oh, it hasn't been thought out yet because they hadn't made Zelda 2 yet.
Yeah.
I mean this game does things that nobody else does. For better or worse. And in a lot of ways that provides, especially I think to experienced veteran gamers, it can provide a certain sense of wonderment that this was a thing that maybe I was alive when it came out and a decent number of our listeners weren't. And they're like, maybe this was around when I came out, but I was totally unexposed to it because you were. It was a TG16 game. Nobody listening to the show owned a TG16 when this game came out. I'm willing to bet money on it. Somebody's going to lie and say I owned one, but you're a liar. You didn't.
I literally didn't even know anyone who owned a TurboGrafx. I don't think I knew anyone who'd even played a TurboGrafx.
I didn't. I had never seen one until 2002.
I heard about it on like Nick Arcade. You know, that was like my exposure to it. It was on TV.
I had played the, you know, the first stage of Keith Courage at the Radio Shack in my town.
Radio Shack.
But that's
Shack.
About it. Yeah.
Wow.
I know.
Wow, there's so many dated references in that one sentence that I can't even begin to contextualize them. But, you know, I think there's a certain amount of charm in seeing, you know, this is fundamentally I can't even say this is a good game or a bad game because it's so fundamentally opposed to what we experience and what we've grown up and what our expectations have matured into that it's hard to put labels on this game. I enjoyed the game for what it was, and maybe if gaming had, you know, grown in the direction that this game had sort of staked out, maybe I'd look back on this game and think this is just really bad. But in its primitiveness and yet its so distinctness, it became sort of this charming experience. I mean, I think just all the little flourishes, like Yale mentioned, of just showing off, no, this is seriously, guys, this is a CD. You are getting some kicking butt rock in the middle of this game, even if it doesn't make sense, is so is so just invigorating. I mean, I said this at the time, but the first boss in the game is literally a rock concert. He stands around, doesn't do anything, flames come out of the ground, and it plays butt rock. It's a rock concert. It's not a fight. There are pyrotechnics.
It's like something out of Brutal Legend.
And guitar riffs. And a guy in a cape. That is an early 90s, late 80s rock concert. It just is. And it's beautiful.
So, Alex, I mean, you have to have had a different experience than the one we're describing. Because you played the remake. Yes. So, what did you get the feel, you know, this like insanely old school, before my time kind of vibe from it that we did?
Yeah, like, what did they modernize exactly?
Okay, so I'm going to have to talk about quite a few things as I'm answering this question. No, it's not going to be too overblown, but I think one of the biggest things about this is that while you guys are like 30 to like, and I think like maybe 25 to 30, I'm 18 and didn't actually grow up around this time. Right, I experienced all my NES stuff like later, like in the early 2000s.
Oh.
So I don't have much to compare it to.
You don't have what I ended up with credentials? Come on.
Well, I mean, I saw the Angry Video Game Nerd episode, but
that's all you need.
So the way the Steam version works is it's a lot of the stuff that the TurboGrafx version has, but it all looks nicer. Like, while the TurboGrafx has TurboGrafx graphics,
let's just say PC Engine for the sake of that sentence.
Quote unquote 16-bit.
The PC version has graphics that look eerily similar to To the Moon, where it's kind of like the Super Nintendo, but it just looks a lot higher res.
Oh, weird.
Okay.
And the music is a lot like that, too, where You can tell it wasn't made with real instruments, but it sounds pretty close. And what this ends up being is the gameplay from 1987 combined with all this stuff that's closer to a PC game of today. It ended up playing to me like a really shitty indie game.
That's funny.
You know, it's funny that the music in this game isn't recorded by real instruments, because it very much is in the original game.
Granted, it's a combination of synthesizers and real guitars, and I think in some cases real drums.
Real
also.
Guitars losing their minds. It's awesome.
It was probably Redbook audio too, so you could pop that in the CD in your car and listen to that.
Oh yes.
And you know people did.
I would be lying if I said I haven't procured the soundtrack for this game just out of the sheer comedy of it. Because it is Lords of Thunder level of just stupid. I mean, it's beautiful.
It's not quite as hi-fi as Lords of Thunder, you know, and Lords of Thunder is almost literally heavy metal on a disc.
Yeah.
This is more like video game music. If the composer was a hair metal guitar player from the 80s.
Oh, yeah.
So in some aspects, it still sounds like video game music. It just also sounds like heavy metal at the same time, which is very unsettling.
It's beautiful. You know, I was thinking about this, and we've sort of looped around it a couple times. This game feels like what they would have shown kids playing on the TV in a movie in, like, 1992. Like, this would have been how they showed video games. And I'm almost certain this game has shown up in a movie somewhere. Because you just look at it like, this is what everybody says games are in movies. Congratulations. All it needed was the Pac-Man sound effects. It'd be good to go.
We need to wrap up the discussion, and luckily, you know, we have a whole other part two coming in a couple of weeks where we can spend more time talking, because it sounds like we all have more to say about this.
Oh, I love this game so much.
But I do. Well, I wanted to get to that, because I think it seems like we've come to a couple of different questions, and I really think they mean two different things. So I want to go around and ask all of you guys, A, do you like this game? And B, do you think it should be played? I mean, do you think it justifies your existence? What I mean is, do you think it has historical significance? Is this something that, like, people who want to educate themselves about video games, is this something that they should play? And that's a separate question from how do you personally feel about it and do you really enjoy it? So I'll start with Alex.
You know, Johnny, I really hate this game. No, I'll be honest, I hate this game. But I'm so glad I played it at the same time, because, you know what, I did not know what to expect. Oath of Fel'Ghana didn't really grip me, and I was playing this over, what, like a Tuesday afternoon, basically, just to finish it. And what I ended up with was Forrest Gump cross Diablo. And you know what, it wasn't good. The Darm tower design was absolute shit. Like, I'm not even going to say, oh, it's kind of clever. No, it was garbage. The backtracking was garbage. The mirror design was garbage. The bosses were pretty fun, though. But you know what? I've never played a game like that, and I sort of have a video game fetish for playing games like that, no matter how shitty they end up being.
Great success.
There we
okay,
go.
Guillaume, what about you?
I just, hey, this game is old. It's much older than I thought. It completely changes the way that I'm looking at it now. So I think that while I was playing it, I was disappointed. I thought, I was thinking about it as like a contemporary of Link to the Past.
No, it's a contemporary of the original Zelda game.
Seriously, that blows my mind. So I think I'm going to enjoy Book 2 more just because I have the context. Like, it's a little bit like, you know, like watching Psycho for the first time. You know, like, if you don't understand that this is, like, the origin, this is the one thing that everyone else copied, and it's really, really, influential.
That's a great comparison. That's a great comparison.
Yeah, like, I'm not sure, well, I wouldn't call, okay, don't quote me as saying that Ys Book 1 is, like the Psycho of video games, but it's definitely,
there's your episode title.
It definitely changes the way I'm looking at it. And I think that if you go in knowing that, you have a better chance of enjoying it.
Cool. Yeah, and I think you probably will enjoy book two more because it is, you know, it's more goes in the direction of what you were talking about with E7, where the combat system is more sophisticated and you have more mm-hmm. options. And that is true in book two from what I remember of playing.
Yeah, I mean, since the game literally just boots you into book two when you complete book one. I mean, just
yeah.
The few seconds I was in there, visually, it looked more
yeah. It was made later, and it looks nicer, and it's a little more polished, I think.
Mm-hmm. I mean,
so, James, what about you? You said a minute ago you love this game. Are you going to hold to that?
So well, yes. So, here's, but it's this answer is more complicated than that. I don't like this game, but at the same time, I love this game. It's weird. Like from a pure gameplay standpoint, if I was reviewing this game, I would probably savage it, but I still love this game. Like, this just emotionally, I'm very attached to it very quickly. This game, I've had all the highs and lows you have in a bad relationship or even like I've had moments where I'm just like, game, fuck you. I'm done. We're out. This is over. And then I've had moments where I'm like, all right, game, we're back on. This is hilarious. Let's do this. I mean, there was a moment at this game.
Are you saying, are you enjoying it ironically, or are you authentically having good experiences with it?
I'm having good experiences, not in spite of the game. I think I'm having good experiences because the game is what it is. I look at it to a certain extent and go, wow, this is really dumb. But at the same time, I don't care, or I love it for what it is. It's the fact that this one dumb loaf gets off a boat and immediately is told he's going to go save the world, and the first thing he has to do is go shopping. It's like, you know what? I'm cool with this. This is insane, but I love it. I mean, you sit there and you go, game, what the hell? And you're like, you know what? No, it's fine. It's great. This is awesome. The bad voice acting, every time it came in, and I would just start laughing to myself. I couldn't help it. Not because it was bad.
It's just bizarre.
Just the game is so weird and so wonderful for it. And there's nothing like this. I mean, you could ask, have you ever played a game like this? The answer is no, unless you've played this game. It's so siloed. There's nothing. Nothing came out of this game of itself. So you're sort of experiencing something that, unless you played the original Ease, you've not seen before. And really, much of it you've never seen since. So it's sort of having that experience of wonderment for playing a game of this style for the first time, because it probably is. I mean, you don't get that a lot these days. I mean, what's the last time you played a game? I've never played a game like this before.
Yeah, Etrian Odyssey.
Well, yeah. Yeah, that's true. But I mean,
I take it you're saying, yes, people should play this.
Yeah, I think definitely. I think from a historic standpoint, I'm not sure its role in history is especially significant, because like I said, I don't think a lot evolved out of this game. It's mm-hmm. the Australia of video games. But but I think what you end up with is kangaroos are still really awesome to look at, so you should go look at this game.
Oh, wow.
I think that's ultimately what it comes down to.
I'm loving these comparisons tonight. For my money, I think Ease is a total mess of a game.
It so is!
But I am gleeful playing this game. I think it's just mechanically so fun to play. And I'm willing to put up with a lot of shitty design choices when a game is just fun on a very raw, basic level. And I think this one is. I think this game is just crazy, crazy fun to play. And book two is going to amp it up because it's going to maintain that stuff while fixing a lot of the problems. So I'm looking forward to getting deeper into that. But, I think this is definitely a game you should play. I mean, it's just, I agree with a lot of what James said. It's just odd. It's totally odd. It's very accessible. You know, I mean, it doesn't slam you with a bunch of text up front. It's not
or
stat
any, really.
Heavy. It's, you know, it doesn't have a lot of weird systems to learn or anything like that. It just kind of throws you out in the world and says, dude, go for it, you know? And I think, it, you know, even though it almost requires some kind of guide or online map to play through. I mean, you would have gotten a magazine back in the day or from a friend, or maybe drawn your own maps if you're very patient. In this day and age, it's even easier to play the game. It's more convenient because you do have the resources that we have. But I totally think people should go check this out, you know, in whatever format, whatever version you want to go look for. But you know, I enjoyed it back when I played it, you know, 4 or 5 years ago when it first came out on Virtual Console, and I had a great time replaying. I played all the way through Book One over again, and I don't regret it for a second. So that's going to have to wrap up our discussion. And thanks to everybody who's been posting in the forum thread. And of course, that thread will stay open and we will use it again for next time. So here's the good news. If you haven't yet started Ease Book 1 and 2 and you're intrigued in any way by the discussion that we just had, you can play through Book 1 easily in time for the next part and make some progress into Book 2. And still participate. So I hope that we've turned some people onto the game and that they're going to give it a chance. And, you know, please leave your thoughts in the forum thread because we'll be looking for a whole bunch more quotes next time as well. So that's going to wrap up the episode. Also want to remind everyone you can send emails to rfn@nintendoworldreport.com. It's going to be a couple more weeks before we get a chance to get back to the mailbag, but we're always accepting and we hang on to those, trust me, and we'll go through and pick out all the best ones. And of course, we'll be seeing some of you at PAX East in a few days. And for our fourth, I know, it's really close.
Oh my God.
But it's going to be our fourth annual live panel, and I'm super excited. Of course, we are going to get a recording of that, and we will put it up on the podcast feed, so you'll be downloading that just like you did this episode, and it should be a lot of fun. And finally, thank you very much to Alex, our guest this week.
You are very welcome.
Yeah, man, I really appreciate it. And Alex, by the way, played through Ease Book 1 in record time in order to help us out. So, I really appreciate it, man. I know you put some effort into it.
Yeah, thank you.
All right, guys, that's all for this episode. We will see you next time in Boston, right here on Radio Free Nintendo.
Intoxicating.
Woo!